Hello and welcome to the Culture File debate. I'm Luke Clancy and we're coming to you this time from in front of a live audience at the Irish Museum of Modern Art in Kilmainham. In the context of the museum's current exhibition, Take a Breath, we're talking about the habit and the habitus of breathing. What happens when we, as our yoga instructor advisors, focus our attention on breath? Not just our in-the-moment attention, but artistic attention, ethical attention, political attention. Breathing offers many things, among which is a nice image of how we might too often move through the world, vaguely automated, largely inattentively, involuntarily, until we choose to, or are forced to, pay attention, at which point we and our world change. We might feel the air as the commons and experience our responsibility to everything that shares it with us. We might understand the violence of depriving others of clean, safe air. We might become aware of our own thingness, of our own connection to something beyond things, aware of our own finitude. How many more breaths will this body take? Or of a beckoning infinitude? If the algorithmic feeds are helping to collapse common culture, perhaps it's breathing that might fill that space, an activity nobody can imagine doesn't touch or concern them. So joining us to talk about the floating world of breath, we have our panel this evening. Just in from the end there, we have Isabel Nolan, who's an artist whose work you can see as part of the Take a Breath exhibition in the halls above us. And her practice explores order, systems, and scientific narratives with a careful consideration of the moments of making. Hi, Isabel.
Hi, Luke.
That's Isabel, in case it was confusing up
Hello,
to that
everybody.
Moment. right at the... I'm trying to do the boy-girl thing here. Almost in the middle is Ian Robertson of the Global Brain Health Institute, who's a clinical psychologist, neuroscientist, and author, who, among other things, has worked with art and aging initiatives here at the museum. Hello, Ian.
Hello, Luke.
And Nina McGowan is an artist and champion freediver. Her work explores transcendence and the experiencing body. She holds a world record and several national records in freediving. Hello, Nina.
Hi, Luke.
And the call coming from inside the house this time is from the head of programming at Emma Mary Kremen, who's the curator of Take a Breath and has given us all our reason to be here this evening. So thanks for that, Mary.
Good evening, Luke.
So, Ian, I thought maybe we could start with a little breathing exercise, because, you know, when people gather together, that's what they do. They're going to breathe each other's air, and we could do that in an organized fashion. But I can see many of the audience are actually breathing at the moment, so we've had a good start there. But first, what is it that's happening, this thing, when we're breathing? When we breathe, humans breathe in and out, what's happening?
Well, it's one of the cycles of nature. We have cycles. We have cycles of sleep-wake. We have cycles of dark light. We have cycles of the year. But the breathing is the most fundamental of cycles. And we know that how regular that is and the pace of it shapes who, to a great extent, how we feel and who we are. And it is probably the most underestimated and underused capacity that we have for connecting with the world, but also with regulating our own internal world.
And tell us a little bit about the physiology of all that.
So when we breathe in, our brains, critical part of our brain called locus coeruleus, which is the source of a critical chemical messenger, neurotransmitter in our brain called noradrenaline. When we breathe in, the firing of the locus coeruleus changes, and when we breathe out, it changes again in a cyclical way. And if we're coming up to the Olympics, all great sports men and women, particularly in things like archery and shooting, have to become expert about when to let go the bow or when to shoot, because the state of their brain will depend on the state of the breath. And it's on the out-breath that this chemical messenger neurotransmitter, noradrenaline, is at its optimal level. And so that helps when it's at its optimal level, the different parts of the brain are resonating together. Yet another series of cycles are resonating together at about 40 cycles per second. And so you're in a state of intense focus. And that's when you get elite performance.
Okay, so we want some elite performance from the audience this time. So a state of intense focus, as might be required for a radio program. Would you lead us in a little breath? Tell us what you're going to do. And I hope I can count on everybody to join in a little breathing exercise. It'll do you good.
Yeah, so what I'm going to do is to get you to roughly try and change your breathing to approximately 6 breaths a minute. That is one breath every 10 seconds. That is a breath cycle. We all have our different optimal frequencies, but on average, 6 breaths per minute leads to activation of the parasympathetic nervous system. That is the relax and digest branch of a system whose other branch is the one that gets us excited and anxious and activated. So these two are in opposition. When we breathe in the way we're going to breathe now, we stimulate a reduction in overall activation of our autonomic nervous system, and that gives a feeling of relaxation and calm. And that happens particularly if you breathe out for slightly longer than you breathe in. So I'm going to get you to breathe in to the count of 4, your own count of 4, okay, and out to the count of 6. And we'll do that a few times. You can either close your eyes, you don't have to, or not. Okay, so you just breathe in. And out. Do that again, and remembering to breathe out for slightly longer than you breathe in. But don't make it effortful, and you don't have to make it as slow as I'm counting. You can do it at your own pace. Breathe in and out. And do it once more. Breathe in for 4 and out for 6. And you have just changed the chemistry of your brains in a positive way. If you've been feeling pressured or anxious in particular.
And does that set you up to enjoy things more, does it?
Well, what it does is whether we enjoy things or not is usually dependent on the state of...
And if they're any good or not.
Say that again?
If they're any good or not, it depends a lot on...
Yeah, yeah. But your beautiful introduction, Luke, I think very, very impressive. Account of this, the role of attention in our experience of the world, in our emotions. So basically what we pay attention to affects who we are and how we feel and what we think. And the breath is the most immediate and powerful instrument of controlling our attention. Yeah.
So out there, did you feel your attention now more available for what's going to happen? So that's the question of taking control of breath. And the reason we wanted to talk to Nina tonight is that Nina McGowan is a free diver, which means that she pays an awful lot of attention to not breathing, which is kind of almost contrary to what Ian was suggesting there. But maybe not that devoid. Tell us a little bit about what being a champion of free diving means in terms of the attention you pay to your breathing.
Free diving is breath hold diving, or the Latin is apnea, meaning the withholding of the breath. So it can be described in those ways, but essentially it's a sport. It can be recreational. What I do is the sport kind, where I'm trying to push myself to, with others in a competition situation, I suppose, to see how far we can go. But obviously it takes a lot of training and figuring out how to hold your breath and maximizing your oxygen consumption, making it the most efficient, is where the skill comes in. management of airspaces and where we hold the breath within the body. But crucially, the piece that will make the dive a success is the relaxation phase before the dive, where we're doing just, Ian, as you described, the slowing down with the bias on the exhale to bring the whole parasympathetic nervous system into kind of alignment. What I would typically do is face down in the water with a snorkel, and I'll be wearing a nose clip, so I'm breathing in that through my mouth and doing these cycles of 4-6, 4 inhale and 6 exhale. But the other thing, what I'm trying to do is activate the mammalian dive response. So sensors are just here under your eyes. Scuba divers don't feel this because they have a mask on, but I don't. So when my face goes in, this is a kind of a primordial software, effectively, in the human body that allows us go into, in a way, hunt mode. So it knows we're in water and it knows we're about to go into a state of breath hold, and it allows us to get parasympathetic and to hold our breath for way longer than you might suspect on dry land. So the water combined with that breathing sequence, I suppose, is what is the starting point.
But there is the sport, and you're trying to, I mean, for you know, people who aren't familiar with this, free divers like Nina will go below the water to 60 metres, roughly?
I'm doing 63 metres now.
63 metres. you know, well beyond the range of most ordinary people, and that's the sport. But I get the feeling that your involvement with it, because you come from an artistic practice, that your involvement with it is more than to do with, sporting achievements and all the free scuba gear that comes with that.
I'm really interested in the conscious space that comes of the effect of the blending of gases through the pressure. I'm really interested in the release of the metronome of time that the breath seems to anchor us to the land. I'm really interested in the potential for the reset of society to go into a place that's kind of like the experience of color field painting. The blue in a Rothko, he said 18 inches was the ideal space to experience, because you're completely immersed. When I'm neutral, buoyant, I get to release my body from the species of human in some poetic way, or the potential for it, and to live a life beyond the breath. So there's a bit of a trans species or something. I'm trying to find empathy and resonance with the world in a way, because I find a lot of society kind of, and especially the time piece that we're forced on, oppressive. So
yeah, I mean, the
experience
idea of
this, yeah.
The idea of time is very bound up with the question of breath. Like that sense of aging and that sense of progressing through life comes with each breath. Are you escaping that?
I don't know. Well, maybe the amount of breaths you take, quantify the amount of years, I don't know, by holding my breath for 2 or 3 minutes at a time. I don't do it enough to have any consequence, I suppose, but
but you've spoken about entering into a dimension that's like almost unrelatable to the world the rest of us are experiencing when you're under the water at 60 meters, that pressure, no breathing.
Yeah, the sense of yourself is changed, and we're managing our emotional field because you are 60 meters underwater and you've got to come back up once you've reached your target. So you can't allow any anxiety to come in, and you're feeling the pressure. You have to be soft. Like, there's a lot of yogic stuff, and the pranayama comes into this. Pranayama is breathing practice, but it's also the absence of breath as well. So what we say underwater, or what doesn't bend will break. So we try to keep our body very soft. So there's different stages of the dive, obviously. You'll feel different things. The hypoxic moment at the end when you're running out of oxygen can make you feel elated. At the beginning of your dive, you might be quite stressed because you're using a lot of force to take yourself beyond the buoyancy of your lungs. And then you'll reach neutral, where you're just free falling, the weight of your body is pulling you through. But
and I mean, in a way, you are hunting that. You're searching for that. Like this hypoxic reaction you're getting. And I mean, we've seen photographs. I don't know if everybody's seen photographs of Nina at the end of a dive, and she's lost consciousness and through not breathing. But in a way, you are searching for whatever the experiences that are peppered around that are.
I'm looking for an alternative to the land here, to the constraints of everything. There's no linguistics, there's no physical gesture, nothing relates underwater, and you've got absolute sovereignty and agency for you to invent as you go this space and own it in the presence of the moment without the metronome of time that's going to put you into it. It feels like there's a lot of possibility there. I haven't got the answers, so I keep going back, so I don't know how to answer this, but
as long as you keep coming back up here as well, that's okay. So, you know, there's a case where not breathing can bring about kind of personal extinction. And Isabel, you've kind of been thinking about this not breathing thing in a kind of global sense of an extinction event that, you know, that you've become interested in. So I think it's in the background of your work that's in the Take a Breath show, that there was a time when oxygen wasn't the element that we were all living in, and oxygen didn't drive life on Earth.
Well, I guess, I mean, really, that was some intensive Wikipedia research on my part rather than anything I can kind of claim to have great knowledge about. But I was interested in it because it just, to me, it speaks to the kind of contingency of our, you know, physical nature, and the fact that there were bipedal things with a particular set of respiratory, you know, lungs and a system and stuff like that. And I'm always interested in sort of recalling and like harking back to these moments when everything could have been different. So between 2.4 and 2.1 billion years ago, the Earth was completely toxic to the kind of life forms that we have evolved to be. And there was they don't count it as a mass extinction, which seems a little unfair on all the kind of bacterial, I can't remember now what they are called, all of the kind of inhabitants of the planet that were wiped out when suddenly there was this uplift and oxygen became kind of the dominant gas in the atmosphere.
Which was poisonous for them.
And it was poisonous. So they died to pave the way for us. Just very, yeah.
And how did that feed into your work, do you, as an idea? I mean, it kind of, I suppose it decenters people in a way to think that we are only one kind of possible elaboration of how the molecules of Earth could be put together.
Well, I mean, I think in terms of the exhibition in a kind of wider sense, and it forces you to think about something that, you know, should be completely something that should be unconditional, has suddenly become beset with conditions that we need to think about as a species and as an individual. But within that, I mean, my work is one kind of particular thing, but kind of in the broader, my broader thinking, I'm very interested in drawing attention back to physicality, because I think that's what artwork does. For me, artwork is not like a retinal thing. It's a very somatic thing. And, you know, when you're having an experience, it's a bit like, it's almost like some of the things Nina was saying. I was going, like, I barely, you know, I can barely swim. But for me, that's going to an exhibition and finding something I haven't experienced before is a little akin to that kind of sense of being both really, really centered in your body and slightly out of it at the same time. And I think there's something, again, that's like, it's a really, I mean, I think Mary's a bit of a genius because it's such a mobile metaphor for kind of thinking about
fluid.
All sorts of very fluid metaphor, gaseous also. But just in terms of like, because one of the things I also really think about, and that does pertain quite directly to the work that I made for the exhibition, is our sense of interiority and how we meet the exterior world and how as, you know, creatures with this quite, you know, developed intellect and how we mediate reality for ourselves, and whether that's scientifically or religiously or physically, we have all these different ways. So it's important to me that you're always kind of called back into your body when you're in an exhibition, and that you're not like, you're not denying the kind of emotional and the psychological and the sort of physical experience of, you know, seeing art.
With a piece like the rug in the exhibition, I think of the duration of making, but I'm kind of imagining you in front of it, and that you might begin to center on your breath and on your own bodily experience as you're working. Tell us a little bit about the working experience of making in that way.
Yeah, I mean, it was a straightforward commission in the sense that when Mary spoke to me, because it's towards the end of the exhibition, which Mary may speak about, that she's wanted to take people out of a sort of the slightly more political and contested space that features in the work of other artists into something a bit more meditative. And it's kind of funny because I'm probably comically unmeditative and anxious. So I think I'm constantly like pursuing it through my practice and trying to find ways of, and again, it speaks a little to what Nina said, trying to find a way to relate to the world and to love a world that can be very hostile and kind of problematic. I have slightly forgotten the question, but the point I think that I'm trying to go towards is that, so I immediately thought that there should be a kind of a secular chapel space and something that would be an entirely kind of cultural experience that takes you hopefully to a feeling of being in nature. And there's something about, again, it's one of those things that's a very, I think it's one of the greatest puzzles that sort of besets humanity is when we decided that we were somehow different to the natural world and sort of separated ourselves out from that. So I can't speak to what effect it has on people, but in a sense, like some of the decisions were very, very simple. Initially I thought, oh, maybe the room should be blue, and I thought that was kind of cold. And then I decided to paint the room this like very bright, like too bright, almost sunlight yellow, because I wanted it not like to be a place where somebody might have some contemplative time or just be brought back into their body or something a little kind of uplifting, because some of the material in the show is very dark and I was commissioned to be uplifting in this instance. So there's something about just making this sort of kind of loose, like it's an idea of a landscape, it's not really a landscape. And that was reflecting on, you know, something that you learn about in school, that we wouldn't have oxygen if it wasn't for the oceans, if it wasn't for the green, the plants and the trees, and this kind of cycle that we inhabit. And the work also sort of references the kind of form of a stained glass window, and it's very highly coloured. So it's really, you know, there isn't, it's not a troubling work, I would say. And that's probably as close as I can come to asking people to kind of be a bit quieter or slow down a little and maybe, yeah, enjoy being a human with a set of lungs for a few minutes.
You could give those seagulls a word as well.
Yeah. They're all the species are welcome. You know. But Emma's policy dictates, I guess, you know.
Mary, I mean, Isabel touches on it there. In the exhibition, you're really quite open to the fact that breathing is not a kind of an unpoliticized space and that maybe there's a lot going on. And particularly, I guess, the inspiration of the exhibition must be in the past few years when we had these global events like COVID and we began to see there were racialized quality in who might have free access to clean air and who might be most troubled by not having. And it seems like it's not as though that period has disappeared. If it seems the American president now has COVID again, it's sort of like wandering around the community and revealing kind of strange patterns. But tell us a little bit about that matrix that brought the exhibition into focus. And as we were saying, it is a highly politicized exhibition in places.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the when I started thinking about this exhibition, it was post-COVID, although we're still in COVID.
Post-COVID though, you know?
I guess that really demonstrated the inequity of breath and in terms of who gets access to clean air, who gets access to respiratory systems, but also thinking of the Black Lives Matter movement, with I Can't Breathe being that slogan. So you're looking at that type of inequity as well. So like within the exhibition, you have Blenda Kazim, who's got a piece called Respire, where she interviewed people in Liverpool, primarily Black people, and within that community, but she created a composition piece called Keep On Keeping On. But her piece is much more about Black power and Black breath as something revolutionary, so something much more powerful. So there's different ways, I guess, of approaching breath within that exhibition, and I designed it through chapters. So the first one is around feminism, and female voice as well. So one of the first pieces that you come into contact with is, her name just went out of my head. Anna Mendieta. So she did this piece called Burial Pyramid, where she inserts herself into the earth and she breathes. So you can see her breathing in the video piece, and it's quite dramatic. But in her, she's aligns herself with like indigenous, but Black and brown people, and this piece was made in the 70s. And she was responding against a kind of very male-dominant colonial takeover of land art through people like Robert Smithson and Michael Heiser. So she was really looking at the femininity and the connection of the feminine and the indigenous to nature. So for me, that was a really important place to start with a female voice.
But I mean, in the exhibition, that's not even the beginning, because as you carefully point out, there are historical pieces there, and our atmosphere, our air has always been kind of feeding into artistic production of one sort or another.
Yeah, I mean, within the exhibition, there's a Turner painting, and for me, what I always found fascinating, my background is geography, so I've always been very interested in the environment. And in the 1815, around that period of time, that's when Turner was painting, and there was volcanoes in Tambaruna. So for 5 or 6 years post that time, there was a loss of dust particles in the air, so it totally changed the atmosphere and the sunsets. So I was in New York last year after the forest fires in Canada, and you could see the air was totally orange, and it totally changed the atmosphere and the sunset. So Turner, that's what Turner was experiencing at the same time. So the idea is that it's quite holistic, that what happens in some part of the earth affects all of us, that we're all connected. So I think Turner really kind of demonstrates that. And within that room, there's a piece by Yuri Patterson, which is kind of a real digital work, where it documents the CO2 that's in the gallery space at the time as you occupy it, and it changes as you see digitally, like into a digital sunset. But for me, it's really important to make those connections. Similarly, Shelley wrote Frankenstein in 1816 when there was a year of no summer. So everyone was trapped inside and people didn't even know if the sun was going to return, because it was just this totally fogged out space. So for me, it's really interesting to see the cultural impacts these kind of climatic events have. They're not always catastrophic, but they, you know, even when you think about what's happening in Sicily now, or when we had the Icelandic volcano as well, how that grounded everybody, and that impacted our air as well, because people couldn't fly, so we had cleaner air and access to cleaner air. I think everybody kind of noticed at the time. So it's kind of just thinking about everything much more connected.
Yeah, and I mean, the exhibition, which is terrific, it does move backwards and forwards between this idea that breathing can be something very personal and can connect us to things that we maybe find difficult to access, and this other thing, which is people like forensic architecture and the work you described, who are measuring. And the job of the artist is to kind of measure in quite an interesting way. We assume at some stage maybe measuring was taking in the data and creating a work from it. But in many cases now, that the business of measuring is literal measuring of components of air.
Yeah, so Lawrence Abdulhabnan's piece, Air Conditioning, is data collection, but it's looking at it through sound as well and air pollution. But he's looking at post 2006, I think, when Lebanon and Israel had their peace agreement, that Israel still came into their airspace. And he documents it from 2007 to 2022. So it's a 53-meter-long piece, which is a data piece that documents that. And it's this idea of slow violence, where it's a Brian Dixon coined that term. He's a geographer, but he talks about it as in the catastrophe that's a very slow rolling out of something that happens over time. It can be over millennia when you look at deforestation, but through warfare, it has much more of an impact. And forensic architecture, a really interesting group that do a lot of kind of restaging events or war events especially. They do a lot of work around Palestine and Israel. But in this piece that we brought here, it was looking at protest movement and the use of tear gas and the excessive use of tear gas and how that impacts protesters and the respiratory system. So the use, government's use of suppression of protests through these methods as well. So it is very politically loaded, this idea of oppression, I guess, in some ways. And also this idea of, I see breath as loss of language, which is also a chapter within the exhibition that's looking at colonialism and post-colonial nations that have lost their languages. Susan Hiller has a beautiful piece there that looks at the last time certain indigenous languages were spoken. And even in terms of Irish language, I was trying to find artists that, that had made work about the loss of the Irish language. And I think that's something that we're still trying to deal with as well in terms of a kind of post-colonial nation, because it's a big part of our culture, it's a big part of our identity, and colonialism is something that, that it tries to deplete that.
Yeah.
Sorry, I could keep going, but stop there.
It's a great exhibition. Everybody needs to go and have a look. There's a thing, an expression that we kind of are, maybe it's deprecated a little bit, we're not quite sure that we want to use it anymore. And I think I look at something like forensic architecture and I think I'm very, very interested in this art and I think this is what needs to be made. But it doesn't have a response that we talk about as used to be a marker of important art, which was that it took your breath away. And that sort of somatic reaction to art is, as I say, it's not something that maybe it feels sustainable anymore. It feels maybe like an inappropriate way to respond to art. What do you think, Isabel? I would say almost yours is the closest to when you enter the room. It does have a kind of physical effect on you almost immediately, I felt. But how do you feel about this idea that maybe giving those kind of responses was not a job for an artist?
I think the good and the bad thing about the art world is that it's incredibly capacious and it's a home to all kinds of ways of working. And I think, you know, I think I disagree slightly, because I know when I was watching that piece, it's one of those pieces where you become very conscious of your body and imagining yourself in the horror of the kind of situation that people are in. And just the idea of imagining, like, whether it's planes going overhead every day. You know, I have a friend who lives in Amsterdam and is driven insane by the amount of air traffic that's going over home, and it's like they're breaking government regulations all the time. They won't do anything about it. So to live in such a kind of tense environment where there's warplanes coming in from another country, like, to me, that is a very kind of physical thing. And you know, and similarly, the idea of being caught up in a protest and subjected to tear gas and thinking about those people who have gone on and have like lung conditions now that they will have to live with for the rest of their life because their government took this kind of action against them. Like, I think that, you know, I think those of all the works and like, I think all the works in the show in a different way do sort of take you back into your body and in negative ways.
So is that a valuable trait? If you stood in front of a picture and it took your breath away, is that valuable?
I think it's rare, to be honest, and I think it's something that you're kind of really chasing, is those moments of complete and utter rest. And I think, like, for me, like, there's one artist in the exhibition, if we can talk about Willie McKeown a little bit and his work that's in the show. So, like, that was something that happened to me when I first saw his work. I kind of walked past it, to be honest, and then I saw another exhibition, and I stopped, and I really looked at these canvases that appeared to be empty, and I suddenly was having an experience with an artwork that I hadn't had anywhere before. And Willie was quite influential, I guess, in the way that I think about beauty, and something about this idea of a generosity and a space that's non-judgmental and unconditional, and how those spaces are quite difficult maybe to find in a world. So he makes these spaces where you kind of dissolve into them, and there's a politics even with that, I think, because it's to do with dissolving boundaries, and it's to do with recognizing that, what's the word, is it proprioception, that, you know, just that, you know, your body doesn't finish at your skin. And I think, again, it's something that comes up again and again in different ways in the exhibition, is you're really made to feel your own body in different ways and to hear everything from sort of the, like, loss of language, to loss of agency, to loss of clean air in a way that's quite dark. And there is a small moment, an effort at the end, to take us into something a bit more positive and meditative with Patrick Scott as well and things. But it's, I mean, fundamentally, because of the architecture of space, you have to walk back the way through. And I think that's also interesting, that you don't get to leave the show on any kind of note of perhaps false optimism. But yeah, so I think it's a really physical show. And I was surprised by that in a way, because when Mary talks about it, it can sound like, and I don't mean this in a remotely critical way, but like some of the subjects, it sounds quite heavy and potentially dry. But I think every work in it has that, hits that like magic spot, which I think is really hard to hit. Because I think what what you're alluding to, sometimes work has a lot of urgency without necessarily having a lot of aesthetic reward. And so I'm generally more interested in the things that I feel are fundamental, and I sort of neglect the urgent a little. But I think within the show, there's a lot of work that speaks to both something very, very fundamental, and it speaks to the kind of urgency of the contemporary moment. So I think that's, and I do think that's a little rare also.
Thank you. Nina, I'm interested in how living that life under the water, being down there in this domain that you can't necessarily bring back, you can't excavate and extract from. But when you then come into our world again and you stand in front of a picture, do you experience it differently? When you experience some art, it mightn't be a picture.
I'm not sure what I bring back. For me, the experience, the primary phenomenological experience of the sublime, I suppose, is what I'm chasing in the practice of the diving. And perhaps that moment of having your breath taken away by a piece of work.
Hard to take your breath away.
Well, but the CO2 piece, Mary, actually is interesting, because I had seen that. It was stunning, the digital, the quality of the surface with the sunset in it. I was actually quite held by that. I mean,
but I'm just wondering if your responses are altered. You know, it seems like what you offer, what to live, to experience what you were experiencing under the water and not breathing and like somehow escaping from the confines of this sort of mammalian prison, should offer some information for you to bring back. And I'm wondering if you are experiencing that, or you do experience that.
I'm looking at the somatic aesthetic quality, so the experience of moving through space. When I'm moving through the water, there's the hydrodynamic sensation of movement, and the, I suppose, even walking through the galleries, my own fluidity of movement through this space and my ability to flit, I guess it's something to do with the sacred being in the biology. And I'm constantly looking back to my own potential of this as a receiving and a broadcasting instrument. The body is our primary vehicle. So, for me, the impact of an architectural scale work, for me as a 5'3" woman, I suppose, the oppressiveness, the negotiation of space with work, from a possibly choreographic way. I've got lots of nuances in, but primarily I'm trying to find new ways to experience the world through the body, and this is helping me. The language, again, is a problem because of the nature of the space, but
it's a disappearing language.
It never existed unless there was something that we had there when we were the ape, the aquatic ape, you know, that came out of the sea. Perhaps we had a mode of communication then.
Ian, tell us a little bit. I mean, we're nearly going to go to questions, but maybe just tell us a little bit about that sense of you were teaching us a little bit about breathing there at the beginning, and it produces some positive effects. You were suggesting, you know, that these were measurable. Are they comparable to art experiences?
I think the answer is yes.
Everything's comparable, I guess. Are they usefully comparable to art experiences?
I risk being anecdotal about that, but certainly my own experience of going into galleries is of that just sense of being taken out of a rhythm or a set of demands into this sublime, you know, often, if you're lucky, sublime space that you were talking about, Nina. And yes, there's now a growing amount of research that being exposed to creative or artistic experiences has, you know, quite a profound effect.
Somatic,
but also on your brain rhythms. And also when people do it communally, for instance, with music, there are remarkable amounts of synchronization goes on between brains, in the rhythms, the cycles between brains. I don't think anyone has looked specifically at the breathing, but I would be surprised if that doesn't synchronize to something.
Well, be anecdotal there. When you're walking into the gallery, what do you experience of your own breathing?
I definitely notice that as it actually happened, as I was listening to these fantastic artists and art practitioners here, I found my own breathing without me slowing to this probably around 6 per minute, and with all that incredibly potent parasympathetic activation of the autonomic nervous system that happens with that. And so that's why art is absolutely crucial for the world and for our well-being. And you know, in terms of the visceral, what Isabel was saying about the bodily experience of art, I just remember the first time I went into a Rothko room in the Tate, and just my breath was taken away, and a non-linguistic experience. And Nina, you were saying about you're free from language, you're away from language, and you're not able to access language when you're down there in the deep. You know, I think in some great art experiences, that's what happens as well. You're taken out of language into a mode of thinking which is no longer linear, no longer with this illusion of time progressing in a linear way. And so I do think, I didn't realize this before this session, but I now realize the comparison between deep free diving and experiencing art is actually quite a remarkable one.
Well, time actually has been progressing in a linear way despite that. And so we're almost going to call a halt to proceedings for this evening. But we have maybe a minute or two for a question or two from the floor, if there is a question or two from the floor. And so Sophie is going to wander around with a microphone. Is that right, Sophie? Yeah. There we go. Would anybody like to ask our wonderful panel a question or two? There's one there.
Thank you. I am super curious to know, Nina, if you experienced Alex Cecchetti's work as a fellow freediver. I'm just wondering how, if you went into that, into the hammocks that he's created that create these kind of cocoons, because obviously as someone who does not freedive, I found being in the space that it did feel like you were under the sea or floating in a different way, and the different textures within the work are really gorgeous. I was just wondering, as a freediver, if you'd been in there yourself.
Yeah, I did see that that piece. I suppose the metaphor of the cocoon space that he created, and for me, resonated with the idea of being held by the sea, that it feels like a safe place at a certain point, because we've taken away anxiety, we decouple emotion from the physiological pressure and the anxiety that should really come from being a place that's so alien to us. And we just feel it in the prima facie in a primary way. So I saw this cocoon thing and I was like, this is the safe space, it's being hung, you're being held.
Thank you.
Mary, I was just wondering if you'd speak a bit more about choosing Mendieta to start as like the first room in the show. Because I was just really struck by how breath is obviously sort of the formal register, the contouring force of that work. And also she is someone who had her breath taken from her. It's really amazing to see the work here. And I was wondering if you could just talk through your thinking a little more.
Yeah, I guess, as I said previously, I'd kind of wanted to start with a female voice. And for me, Ana Mendieta is this amazing Cuban artist. I don't know if people are familiar with her work. And the piece that we're showing is from 1974. So for me, she really represented kind of indigenous, a real kind of feminist mover at a time, but also, as you say, she died quite early. She died when she was 26. She fell from a building, and it's still not confirmed how she passed. So again, her voice was taken away from her. So I'm always very conscious of this idea of the female voice, and the importance of that. And the piece next door to it is by Mercedes, who's an Argentinian artist, and she talks about the potato riots that were in Amsterdam in 1917, where women collectively came together and protested because a lot of the food was being exported. But she also made this connection with the Argentinian movement of women against violence, you know, against women. So there was that kind of slight connection between Ana Mendieta and that work for the people who would be familiar with Ana Mendieta's story. So as well, it's for me, it's moving away from the kind of patriarchal start of things. Again, she was moving away from that kind of very male dominant view at the time in the 1970s. This piece she made was in 1974. Where it was a very male-dominant art world as well. So she kind of marks that shift for me in terms of moving away from that side of things. Also, her work is very performative as well. I was giving a tour a few weeks ago, and this Nigerian woman was talking to me a lot about in Nigeria as well, women would be the ones who would do a lot of the digging, and they would insert themselves into the landscape as well. So he drew a lot of comparisons between that kind of Latin American notion of female Mother Earth, I guess, women being connected to nature, for me is also a very kind of powerful idea as well. Women do seem to be quite connected to nature in a very different way than a male way. Maybe I'm making big generalization there, but it does feel like that way, that there's a bit more sympathy between the two. So. I hope that answers your question. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Have we one there in the middle? And then a gentleman behind.
Hi, I've got a question for Isabel and Ian. Commissioned to make something uplifting, is there a received wisdom on what palette that might be? And if there is it cultural or universal? And that question then pivots to Ian about whether there's neuroscientific evidence on the colours that make us feel joyful.
I mean, that was me paraphrasing a long conversation that was a lot more nuanced, and I'm not sure that the word uplifting ever even got used. I do remember the word cosmic got used. And the colour palette is, colour's one of the things I find the hardest to talk about, and I don't think colour is joyful. And I think children are subjected to an awful lot of colour that they probably don't enjoy for any particular, because we've decided at some point that colour was like childish or playful or something. For me, colour does have a lot of energy, though. And something that it's, you know, and even speaking to the conversation, it's something I've very little control over. And when I'm drawing or painting, that's sort of the moment that I would say that I actually sort of get to a sort of point of flow. And it's when, you know, I'm really not thinking and I'm working into the work and responding to what's happening. And it's an entirely different part of neuroscience world, but I have no mind's eye, so I don't imagine what I'm going to make. I begin to work and something evolves. So all I knew was that I wanted it to be a landscape. And then what came out, came out. So, but I would also be known for my use of colour. And there's like often I find like I use colour with a kind of different, for me it has a different emotional register than the way that people respond to it, and that's fine, that's just how it is. So I don't necessarily see it as uplifting or joyful, but equally, you know, and there's a lot of grey paintings that I love, people who can paint in grey, but it's something that I can't do. I sort of, you know, the colours just jump out at me, and you got to follow that. You know, you have to, it's a bit of a cliche, but you kind of have to get out of your own way. So it's not, it's quite improvisatory. That's what I should have said. Just left it at that.
Thanks,
sorry.
Isabel. So we have one last question.
Well, I think Ian was to respond also.
Sorry,
I don't know.
Oh, just very briefly, yes, there is a neuroscience of colour and of, and yes, colours like bright yellow, like Isabel's piece, will actually raise mood, and dark colours will lower mood, and a certain frequency of blue will make you slightly smarter, and a second frequency of green will relax you. So there's a huge, the colour has profound effects on us, yeah.
Thanks, Ian. There's one more.
Well, just to thank you very much for very stimulating talks. I was back here linking them. saying, I thought they'd be all so different, but there is an essence which seems to run through it. But what struck me was, starting with Ian, that the response to breathing and the release of catechol. But I'm sure he'd be interested in other releases, that the relaxation, that the other chemicals that are released and must be released. And then I wondered whether that meant that Nina was trying to stop all those. She wasn't going to breathe. And are there different ones? And what's the response when you don't breathe? I mean, because what some of us would know is that obviously we breathe to get oxygen and give off carbon dioxide. But there seems to be a lot more to it. And there are all these responses. But in your case, you're denying these to get something else, or is it? So that was interesting in that. And then I heard the colour, and the colour for me was interested at one time in pollution, and not Bacon, but Monet, depicting the same scenes almost, but usually the Houses of Parliament. But the colours that he used were representational. It wasn't about his mood or anything. And they'd spent a long time trying to decide, were these real? Were these the colours they saw? Because if they were, they would give us measurement of what was actually released at a time when there was no analysis and there was no history of it. So that trying to be faithful rather than evoke a mood was what was important in that. And of course, you bring us to the all the other things that are about breathing. Can't breathe, air pollution, freedom from breathing, or freedom from air pollution, and bringing them all, I thought, together. But probably the most startling for me was Nina, which is a denial of everything I think I know about.
Well, then one answer from Nina, maybe. We just have time for...
Well, I suppose what we have to talk about here is the breath hold relationship to the hyperbaria, the pressure that I'm putting, the breath that I've grabbed from the surface and I'm bringing it down. So over the course of that dive, the gases and the way my lungs, my alveoli can accept nitrogen in particular. So the nitrogen narcosis is the effect of nitrogen becoming compressed, and it can go through the blood barrier in the lungs. So it makes you feel slightly drunk a little bit. Some of my friends who are diving to 100 meters plus will have hallucinations on the narcosis, the nitrogen, the effect of the nitrogen on the blood, so you off-gas that slowly. Generally when you're scuba diving, that's what happens with the bends, when somebody comes up too quickly and they don't allow that gas to expel. But for me, I might feel a little bit drunk, a little bit kind of warm and fuzzy at one point, due to that gas, and then on the return, the hypoxic will make you feel that's the lack of oxygen as that gets depleted, makes you feel quite euphoric, actually. So that's the cycle of my feeling over the course of the breath hold, but that's both that I'm running out of oxygen and the effect of the pressure, so it's complicated.
You've made the calculation that it's worthwhile.
It is
overall.
Worthwhile. Yeah, give it a go.
I'm afraid the Kaylee is due to start very shortly, so we must just wrap up. So I have a little bit of thing to say. So, and that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File debate, coming to you from IMA in Kilmainham in Dublin. I'd like to thank our panel, Isabel Nolan, Ian Robertson, Nina McGowan, and Mary Cremen. Maybe if you'd put your hands together for them. And I'd also like to thank you all for coming here this evening, and to thank the listener at home alone, breathing quietly to themselves. We'll be back with the Culture File weekly next Saturday, tea time on RTE Lyric FM, and via podcast whenever it suits you. Till then, bye now.